Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Shop Talk Show. We have two lovely sponsors for you. Lynda.com. That's LYNDA.com/ShopTalk. We'll get you a free week of their service, which is an enormous online learning place. And the Environments for Humans, who are promoting their Responsive Web Design Summit. Go to rwdsummit.com. You can attend it from anywhere in the world. It's an online conference, April 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. We'll tell you more about both of those things later in the show, but for now, let's kick things off.
Guitars, it's another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a sound effects podcast all about front-end web design and development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Tiffer Courier.
That's right, everybody. Thanks so much for listening to our show. We couldn't do it without you. Dave, why is this show special?
Because this is another Watch Out! Rapid fire episode. I like to cause car crashes. That's my personal goal. One accident a year. Keep it simple.
Good. So yeah, not a real gun sound effect, as you know, not on the show. This is just me and Dave. No guests, no drama, no news, no nothing. Just all questions and answer. The secret box. We do this when the secret behind the scenes here is that we like to do this when either Dave or I will be gone a particular week. So we recorded them ahead of time. Not that that should matter very much. These questions come from any time that you guys might have sent them in. We keep every question that's ever been sent in here on Shop Talk Show so that we can answer them at times like these. For example, Von Christoph writes in, I have made something cool with CSS. And then I thought, hey, I'll turn this into a jQuery plugin. I have never done this before. I wrote the code. I made a splash site. I uploaded it to GitHub and then purgatory. What should I do? I haven't announced it yet because I was thinking of like, how do I license it? Do I license it for open source? What's the best way to get people to know about it? That kind of thing. So I had this cool idea, coded it up, put it on GitHub, but is really undecided about what to now do.
Yeah, well, I've released a couple tiny jQuery plugins, so I could probably give you my sort of thing. Put it up online and then make it as free as possible if you want people to use it. This stuff is so easily replicatable. I know people like charge for their little jQuery plugins, and that's okay. Like, I don't want you to not make money, but like, how much money are you going to make? You know,
it needs to be at least like 2,000 lines of code before you start asking for money.
Yeah, that's what I think. And you know, maybe it is. I think start, keep it open source. I mean, I think the MIT GPL dual license is probably the most popular because then people can use it on their WordPress blogs, which is GPL. Or WTFPL, that means you can do WTF you want to do with that thing. Mm-hmm. That's good. I license mine under that, and it's GPL compatible. And then now promoting it, that's really tough. I mean, you could email a podcast with a couple listeners and tell people about it. But I think the big thing is demoing, you know, that if I look at like lettering.js or FitText or FitVids or something, it's like when you demo what problem you're solving and what it does really well, then people get excited and tweet it and you make it on Unheap and, you know, that sort of stuff. Chris?
That's a great, I think Dave hit everything there. Presumably you made this for a reason, right? It didn't just absolutely come out of nowhere. Perhaps somebody had a question and you're like, I could code that. You should, of course, tell them about it. Or maybe you made it for your own website. In this case, maybe we'll just explain a little bit about it, because he linked it to us and he said, hey, this isn't, you know, I'm not trying to get free promo out of you, but, you know, we're happy to share that. We'll share the link. It's at byte-software.co.uk/shards. And it's kind of it just like randomly kind of makes this weird shardy color pattern over stuff. It's cool. It's unique. It's unusual.
Yeah, it's like a futury stained glass kind of feel. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, so. And so like that would be a hard thing to charge for, I would think. So I guess I'd advise not going down that. But so maybe you use it for the header of your own website, and then maybe there's a little link that's like, how did you make that pattern with a question mark? That's a little bit of like normal self promotion for this project, because certainly mm-hmm. some people wonder that, and then they can just find out super easily. But yeah, throw it on GitHub and whatever. This isn't the kind of thing that's going to define your career. It's just was for fun. And I'm sure you're just after a little bit of, I don't know, light back padding that we all enjoy.
Hey, it's always nice.
And I hope you get it.
Fun to put your stuff out there.
It is.
And that's, you know, and congratulations on launching your jQuery plugin, because we just talked about it. So
There you go.
Kaboom. All right. Next question comes from Jan Lacour, writes in, I am a front-end developer working in London, merry old London. My question is about Grunt and Require.js. I'm afraid not able to use them correctly. In the terms of workflow, I just started using Grunt to lint, minify, concatenate my files. Hooray! In terms of performance, I'm used to Require.js for my scripts, plugins, backbone views, etc. Now, if I want to use both techniques, I'm confused. If I concatenate all my JavaScript features, let's say backbone views, into a single file, all of them will be loaded with one HTTP request, right? So if it concatenates, one HTTP. So what's the point of using require? Or should my scripts just be linted and minified but separated? Or better for maintainability and scalability in order to be loaded when required using multiple HTTP requests? How does it work? And then do you have any leads on how I should do it? Do you use require?
No, Chris? I'm really interested in it because I think it solves some interesting problems. It's one of my like embarrassing things that I don't understand as much as I should or whatever. But it's,
you don't know it. I learned it on my last project. So
did you really though? Because you can tell me about it. It does, like, let me try to stab at it and then you can poke holes in my theory a little bit. No, so it's a module loader in a way, right?
I'm gonna find my grunt file.
Oh, good.
While we're working. Okay, go ahead.
Sure. Like you can break up your JavaScript into little easily maintainable, version control friendly little tiny files, right? So like I'm writing a little chat area. Well, the chat will have its own little module that makes chat work, right? It doesn't necessarily need to be squished into the global JavaScript for that file. That's the kind of idea of modules, right? Different parts of your site have different JavaScript files, and then depending on what's going on the page, you load different modules. Do I have at least that part correct?
Yeah. Require like is dependency kind of management, right?
Okay. And so maybe locally you'd want like all those files to be loaded separately, which makes it easier for like debugging and stuff. Tell me exactly what file this is.
You just say, hey, require, get my main requires, or hey, homepage, get my main require script. And then require will start loading in a bunch of other scripts in order and trying to preserve the order and like make calls when you need to. It's sort of like.
One of those is an HTTP request, is it not?
Yeah, each one is.
Okay.
But this is where it gets awesome, is like require has a node tool that will concatenate all those and spit out one big file, right?
Mm.
And so I think his question is he's using like node. Or sorry, grunt concat or something like that.
Right.
In addition to require. And so now it's like confusing because you're kind of like.
So the answer is don't use concat with grunt. Just let require do it.
That would probably be the most sensible thing. I'm trying to find out. Let me see if I have one like called like cool guy optimized, I think. So I don't know where it is. But anyway, So what I did is, let's see here. I had it. I think like my main thing, and I totally lost it. But anyway, the cool thing about Require is like in Require, you're basically creating these really clean AMD modules, which is like the JavaScript kind of spec. I think it's AMD. Somebody's going to correct me, but it's just creates a healthy module. So like your FitText script or something knows to load jQuery. Like it knows it has a dependency, like you've declared the dependency. And so it'll just bubble up. And if you forgot to like require jQuery, or you forgot to put it, Require will like figure out, oh, I need a jQuery. I'm going to put that in there above this thing. So then, like, it does an intelligent kind of tree.
Nice.
Is that okay? Mm-hmm. And then, so when you have to like concat your scripts, like when you're using like grunt concat, you like specify every single script you're doing, right? And you probably can manage like a certain source order, but if you're doing like 100 different scripts that do 100 different things, like the chances of you messing up your array of JavaScript files in your grunt file goes up pretty high, right?
Yep.
But like your chances of messing up like FitText requires jQuery, and then my homepage requires FitText, which then requires jQuery, you're probably less likely to mess up that kind of module system, right?
Okay. So you do not have to really think about the order. It does some secret ordering smartness.
Yeah. I mean, it like there's a grunt require plugin that you can just sub out for your concat, and it'll do all this. So, and then you're going to like want to JS hint all your files, right? You want JS hint your JavaScript or even just your require output, but then you're going to want to minify or uglify it after that. So, you kind of have to think of a flow, right? Like combine, and you can use that grunt require to combine. You can spit that out. And it's pretty cool. Now you're kind of relying on the modules and not your grunt to kind of determine what goes in your module system. I hope that helps.
It does. It's so interesting. It's one of those things where you just got to friggin' use it on a project. And I can't wait to, because it really does sound like a smart way to handle kind of the architectural organization of JavaScript. Or some kind of, isn't it like AMD-like, or what is it? What is that? What does the word AMD mean when we're talking?
I'm just going to murder it. Why not? Advanced module dictation. No, it's just kind of like I don't know, they call them AMD modules. I'm totally blanking on what that stands for though. But it's designed to work. It's good. I like it. What's cool about it is you can have like a main JS, and then you could have a like article JS and just load different JavaScript on your article page, you know, and have a really kind of strict set of articles. And then you compile two different, you know, scripts, like a main JS and an article JS.
Yeah. Okay. There's more to think about there. I think there's another question that we'll touch on this that will be interesting. I should point out that there is a website and a person, I guess, named Integralist, and that was one of the first grunt boilerplate articles I read, and it's still available, and we'll link it up, but it's called grunt boilerplate at integralist.co.uk, and it's a whole grunt workflow that includes require JS. So if you want like a written thing that's like, okay, this is how I do it, we will link that up. Okay, let's do
hopefully we nailed it. Right. Somebody smart comment in the comment box. Thank you. You got one? You got something?
Sure. Well, let's do David Southmountain. Wow. Best last name ever.
I know. He's like a medieval dwarf.
Right.
It's awesome. It's like strong power. He carries an axe.
Yeah, but better. It's better than the one that you came up with, and you could have thought whatever you wanted.
I know.
Okay. I'm sorry. How many JavaScript files do you think are the maximum that you should load on the same page? I'm asking because I'm working on a big time tracking service. Okay, so an app. David is working on a big app, and he's coming up with this probably the same type of stuff that we were just talking about, require.js. There's all this JavaScript and stuff. Like, you want to make, we all know, as few HTTP requests as you can possibly make on any particular page within reason, right? Because there's certainly there's ways that you could screw this up from page to page. What is like a good target, do you think, Dave?
I think it's super,
I know, it depends, of course,
inconclusive. My friend Kyle Simpson, you never say people's names, Getify on Twitter, he like did all these tests, like kind of for performance. He's a performance kind of guy, and he was like testing, like, should I just load one script or should I load two scripts, you know, which is faster, you know, do browsers get two scripts faster than just one big script and stuff like that. And the results were really kind of inconclusive. And it just seems like loading one script, so you just have one execution, one wait, one bottleneck, is maybe the best sort of thing. And that was told to me, I think, by Alex Sexton. So it's the truth. I don't know. I think get it as low as possible. I mean, you're going to have like analytics from other people.
Yeah, know, like, sure. That stuff's like a little unavoidable, right?
Yeah, you got to have whatever that. What's the big one? Quantcast in there.
Man. Yeah, you gotta
have that.
You gotta have a little New Relic. You gotta have a little Google Analytics. You gotta have a little Typekit up in there, maybe.
Well, yeah. So I mean, so it's sort of like depends on your
two or three has been a thing that I've said before, kind of, in that like one is nice if it's a fairly flat site and that it's not that much JavaScript and whatever, even if there's a couple pages and a couple of lines in your JavaScript that aren't used on any given page, at least it will be really well cached then, right? When they do get to that page, that file's already been downloaded and it can run and be useful. Two is like more realistic, I think, in kind of like an app structure kind of thing. There's probably some kind of main that does a bunch of common stuff on your app. Perhaps there's a little JavaScript that powers like your user drop down menu or something, and that's just everywhere. So that kind of stuff that's just everywhere should be in some kind of main or site.js or something. And then like another one that's like more stuff that's a little bit more specific to that page, all kind of squished together. And then maybe, you know, three plus when you start getting into that, like, oh, there's a little Typekit and some stuff going on there. You know, leverage browser caching while you can is the idea, is that it's not all one, I don't think, is always the answer, right? Because then it gets a little too big and unwieldy possibly for some stuff. So load as much as you can practically into that one, and then start splitting it up. You know, you're just gonna have to, I don't know, use your brain a little bit. And I feel like this is exactly true to CSS as well. It's the same thing.
The incorrect answer is 16.
Yeah,
I think, right.
Yeah,
I mean,
correct.
When you like go to a site, and this is, you know, I'm gonna pick on people, but like Drupal or WordPress, you know, they it's like typically just these 42 modules with different scripts that never got concatenated in some kind of pipeline.
Right.
Try to avoid that. Like have some discretion. And then there's cool things you can do, like on CodePen, right? CodePen, you might want to optimize for the pen view, right? Like if somebody goes to like look at a pen, you know, you might just want to just optimize for that, but you don't want to load in the editor in the account creation stuff until there's an editor on the page.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what I was talking about. So there's a global, there's a pen, you know, like if you were on that pen view, there's two pretty much, you know, there's the global and then there's the pen specific one. And that's about it, you know?
And then people do cool stuff like they don't even inject a like the account creation script or whatever until you're hovering over like the account creation button. Like, so on hover, now load my modal scripts and all that stuff.
That's so cool.
There's some pretty cool like performance jukes you can get. If you think about that, I think somebody has articles on that. I think it's Alex Sexton again, but just
this can like, be a little hard. I think in the word, like, you know, we mentioned WordPress a little bit. That's kind of inevitable. And let's say you have like a voting plugin or something there, you know, that needs to be an independent module that you can turn on and off at will and stuff. It makes sense that you can't always concatenate the scripts that come with that plugin with everything else. That's going to require you, if you want to and should, end up not loading all that stuff individually, use some kind of something else that's going to do that for you. And I think there's mm-hmm. tools for that, like the W3 total cache can like see, oh, I see you're loading 6 scripts on this file. I can handle this for you. I'll on the fly go get them and concatenate them before I serve this page. That's pretty cool, you know? Mm-hmm. CloudFront does some of that stuff too on kind of a weird servery fancy level.
Yeah, mod page speed can do that stuff.
Yeah, that's nice. I mean, ideally it should be part of your workflow so that you're not like offloading this work, because you can kind of do it more intelligently with your mind, I feel like, than mm-hmm. automation can do. But anyway.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and it's also like take a honest look at everything. I mean, I coded up my blog, I released it, done. And then I was like looking at my performance, I was like evaluating myself, and I was loading in jQuery and then all these plugins, like my tiny jQuery suite into every single page load. But like only 1 out of 100 blog posts, which I don't even have 100, but like only 1 blog post is using FitVids. So, you know, I probably yeah. need to go to a system where I exclusively load some JavaScript. So that's, you know, something to think about. Like maybe you don't need JavaScript sometimes, but anyway. All right.
That's the thought of the week.
Next question.
Zachary Brady says, I want to set a performance budget. I love that word. I don't know if Tim Cadlett came up with it, but I think of him every time I say the word performance budget because he wrote a great post about it. But I have no idea where to start. I have heard a few vague numbers, but I want to set a reasonable budget appropriate to my projects. There doesn't seem to be any resources, just a lot of articles that say that you should do it. Are there any good articles, you know, or pieces or advice you can give? Zachary, like all people, and I like to talk in absolute terms too, wants to see some real numbers.
So I, you know, I've been looking at this. Tim Cadlick has a post called Fast Enough, which you should read, where he talks about these performance budgets. And the moral of the story is you can't really give an absolute number there, but, the goal is to be 1 second faster. The TLDR is be 1 second faster than your competitor. Because at 100 milliseconds, a user feels like something's instantaneous. At 1 second, a user feels like their flow was interrupted. Like, what the heck? Something just shifted. And then at 10 seconds, a user's like, I'm out of here. I'm done. Bye. Later. Peace out. So the goal is to be 1 second faster. And then Tim goes on to mention there's this thing called the speed index, and that's like a Google rating, you know? Like,
yeah, and it's interesting, right? It's not like the window.load, it's not DOM ready, it's not any of that stuff. It's like some ethereal kind of thing, like when there's enough stuff that has rendered kind of above the fold that the web page looks like it's kind of ready to go.
Yeah, it's like a perceived
yeah.
speed metric, right? Like how fast it feels like the web page loaded. And you know, no one like puts like, you know, your website just has to feel faster than your competitor. But if you go to the post and there's the first comment is Paul Irish, and he's like, my answer to how fast is fast enough is a speed index of under 1,000, which
is 1 second. He's trying to say 1,000 milliseconds.
Basically 1 second. So like, boosh.
Yeah.
Killer. I mean, I'm working on this site, you know, and it's like, you know, got some web fonts and stuff like that. And it's just like, I'm already blown out, you know, of that 1,000 number. So I'm going to have to get kind of clever on how I'm going to get close to it. So it's just interesting.
Yeah.
You know,
this
if
is
Paul says something, my ears peak up, you know, and it's like, what?
Sure. So, and remember that this is it's a weird number, right? You kind of got to just load your site. I think Google does have some kind of way to test for it, but it's kind of like a load your site and like, at what point is it like kind of look ready to go? Like close DevTools, you know, just don't stop looking at your network graphs for a second. Those things are amazing, but like just for a minute, just refresh the page and like, at what point is there like a headline that I can read? You know, or what point is there an important button ready that I can press? That's the 1 second he's talking about, you know?
Yeah.
Not just like how fast did the document get served, or how fast is that red line that says that the window has dot load has fired. Just like how fast does it seem like it's ready to go? I have that Integralist site open just because I was reading this grunt boilerplate, and it's, you know, almost instantaneous, you know, like it's just some text and it's just a flat site. So it's just like, boom, done. Like it's just, yeah, it's way under 1 second. It's like 0 seconds, closer to zero than it is to one. So you want numbers, Zachary? What if that number was 100K? Could you do it? Could you get your site to 100K? Is that possible? Could you remove enough stuff to get you at that number? That's why this number is that's low. I understand. Like, there's most of the sites we work on, they can't be 100K just because there's just not enough stuff we can pack in there to make it a compelling experience or whatever. But like, maybe yours is. Can you set it super low? Can you get it to 1 megabyte? That's a pretty good number. I mean, definitely don't set your performance budget at like 2 megabytes, because then you're like kind of like, I don't know, is that even a budget anymore? That's pretty big.
Challenging. Yeah. Yeah. That's like, hey, I don't care. No. Right. On this last project, like we set an aggressive budget of like 300K for the skeleton of the site. Mm-hmm. That's like fonts, images, or like that, like appear on the site as a whole. Just basically non-content, like the C frame, I call it, but that's weird. Anyway, 300K, 500K will be a stretch because we know like the client's going to add like big, large format images and stuff like that. So we want our responsibility, our doings to be super lean. So that's kind of where we're targeting. That's just where I'm at, just because I know I want to break that 1 second barrier. And if you get over a meg, you've lost already.
Yeah. Those are some numbers for you, Zach. Set an aggressive thing that maybe a megabyte if you can for the whole thing. And then maybe take Dave's 300 number for that kind of, you know, that base C frame.
That should be good. We should try it. Like, I'm going to maybe post my blog. I don't know. I have some stats on my blog if you want to go. Let's see. A brand or newer, Dave Rupert, a brand or newer, I think is what the post is. Yeah, a brand or newer blog. And I posted some like stats or whatever. And yeah, my transfer size is 196K. That's on my
very
site,
good.
On one post.
Very good. So,
and I'm going to make it better, dude. So anyway, try to beat me. Good luck, sucker.
You want to learn stuff? You love learning. We have probably the biggest learning resource there is, at least that's related to kind of technical computer and the world around that, as a sponsor, lynda.com, lynda.com/shoptalk. If you've never had an account there before, go ahead and use that URL because it will get you 7 free days, which is access to their entire library of just thousands and thousands of courses. I like to, they've sponsored before, and it's kind of nice to mention, here's some stuff that just got released, you know, like they are cranking out courses all the time at lynda.com. There's one, lighting design for video production. Like, what if you want to start a video podcast? Maybe you should learn a little bit about how to make that podcast look good. You can learn to do that right on lynda.com. So I've said before, it kind of, they have all this stuff. You could learn about RequireJS on lynda.com. Surely there's a course on that. You can learn about the stuff that we talk about, but you can learn all this other stuff too. And you're not limited in what you can learn. You can just suck down as much as you possibly want to. There's, animate a CSS sprite sheet. So maybe you have an illustrator that you work with, or you're a good illustrator, you can animate that stuff through CSS. There's a course on learning how to do that. Responsive typography tips, agile project management, creating hair in Maya, that 3D tool. Like, there's just the world of courses on lynda.com is unbelievable, and it's more and more all the time. Even when you do have to start paying for it, it starts at $25 a month. So it's super duper affordable, you know? It's like a really good college. For like as closer to free than money, you know. Anyway,
it's pretty awesome,
pretty cool. Go to that. Yeah, thank you. Anyway, what do you got, Dave? You got one?
All right, let's see here. I lost my place. I'm going to scroll on down. Here we go. Jeffrey Shepard writes in. I have just begun learning jQuery through a few online resources, The Lodge being one of them. What is your recommendation of places to learn jQuery from?
Learning
my. Oh, you got
no,
one.
No, go ahead.
So if you've like learned, right, like there's all the schools like, you know, Treehouse and Code School and Code Academy. Those are all good and differing in price structures. But one I like to recommend if you're learning jQuery and you want like the best education, jQuery Fundamentals, jqfundamentals.com. It was put together by the guys and girls at Boku, which is really awesome. But I think this was originally a Rebecca Murphy project. So, you know, it's quality.
Yeah. I reference that regularly. I literally made a whole course on learning jQuery from scratch. So if the idea is you don't have very much experience at all with JavaScript or jQuery, it starts with just about nothing. And it's like 30, 40 videos that's in the lodge. So it sounds like you've already signed up and maybe checked those out. I recommend that for a beginner level, obviously, because I created it and, you know, obviously profit from you doing that. But, you know, I'm pretty happy with that course. And then it takes you what you need to know to get going with this kind of thing. I learned jQuery. I like the book Learning jQuery was very good. When I started out, I still kind of remember that first day when I was like, maybe I should give this JavaScript stuff a try, and kind of read it on a plane. And it really, I don't know, I just give jQuery all the credit in the world for making it seem like such a learnable, doable thing. So cool. Anyway, yeah, get a book, check out JQ Fundamentals. Cody Lindley has a book that's really good on it. Try Treehouse, whatever. There's so many places, man.
I think I got like a SitePoint book called like jQuery Ninja or something. And like, you know, I was still like grokking it. I knew enough, you know, but then I read that and it just like all came together and I was like, ta-da. So, I mean, really it's just like immersing yourself. Give yourself a challenge too. What do we say here on the old show? Just build websites. There you go. All right, next.
Jeffrey Gilbert asks, what's the best way to detect if something is visible in the browser's active viewport? It appears the only way to know is something, if it's not obscured by other markup, if it's below the fold, is to use a flash plugin to detect a drop in frames per second or throttling or something. Doesn't that involve? Yeah. So Jeffrey's question is the first sentence I said there. What's the best way to detect if something is visible in the browser's active viewport? And it is a bit of a complicated question. Do you have anything that comes to mind? I would not use a plugin to detect frames per second throttling.
That sounds like a red herring. I would back out of that strategy. There are like jQuery plugins. Like I think there's like jQuery in view or something of that nature. But basically what you're trying to calculate is, every element has a offset top, right? Like when it's rendered to the page, it has element dot offset parentheses dot top or whatever.
And you know the size of the viewport because you can measure
and
that.
And you know the size
and
of the viewport.
And you know how far scroll down the viewport is because you have access to that, right?
You have window dot scroll top. You have window dot inner height. And you have and width or whatever. Let's just pretend we're doing height only. So, and you have offset top for the element. So you take your window height minus, or no, maybe, oh, this is where
there's math. It doesn't, like, we don't have to go into all every.
Yeah, minus the scroll top. And then you say, is that greater or less than that element's scroll position or that element's offset top? And then that should give you a true or false. And then you can add a class that, like,
sure,
this element.inView.
And that's absolutely the most basic way to do it. It doesn't take in count width. It doesn't get how tall that element is. So basically there's like a finish line. And if this element's very top piece of it has crossed that line, then you're good. You know, so you can get as complicated and mathy as you want about this. Like, does the whole thing need to be visible? Or what if you want to change it to just the bottom of that element or whatever? There's all, you know, these plugins can get a little complicated. But Jeffrey, it sounds like what you're saying, you also mentioned, and it's not obscured by something else. Well, that gets even more complicated because then you have to test if it's, you know, visibility hidden or not, or even, or whatever? Is it kicked off the page left or right to the point where it's not visible anyway? Or is there something with some Z index that's on top of it? And then that starts getting really complicated because there's different Z index context. So you're not only caring about that element, but every other element on the entire page, which Z index context it's in, and then what number Z index it is. This is kind of incredibly complicated. And I think you are trying to maybe avoid some of the crazy math and stuff and just be like, I don't know, Flash, tell me, or take a screenshot and check or whatever. The question is, how, like, what are you trying to do exactly here? Is there a situation in which you know so little about what's going on that page that you need some kind of absolutely foolproof math testing machine? I would think, like, maybe you should just kind of rein in what's going on a little bit here and then simplify that.
Yeah, it might be. I in my use case is always like when in L, like you want to do some like animation when it's in the viewport, you know, you want your picture of a cat to like flip around in a circle whenever it shows up, you know. The quick answer is don't do that, but then the other answer is like, yeah, just kind of figure out if it's in and then start triggering things. Important to know if you're doing like an on scroll thing, like you want to refire this thing every time there's an on scroll, like you're getting into some pretty intensive stuff that might jank up your frame rates per second, which in that case, you kind of want to get into request animation frame instead of your, instead of like on scroll or something like that. So, good luck, man. Hopefully we helped answer your question. Next.
Yeah, let's do our sponsor, Environments for Humans. And I'm sure you've heard all about them if you've ever heard a show before. It's Christopher Schmidt and Ari and their whole family there that puts on all these amazing conferences. They do a bunch of in-person conferences where you literally go and hang out and have cocktails and schmooze each other and talk about the internet.
Business.
Yeah. And then they have online ones too. And if it's an online one with them, it ends in summit, right? They call them their different summits, and they have ones about teaching and CSS and JavaScript. And this one coming up is the Responsive Web Design Summit. So the URL for it is rwdsummit.com. That'll redirect you to the right place, but that's the URL for it. And there's lots of great speakers, and there's talks about performance and techniques and tips and strategies when dealing with RWD and workflow. And then nitty gritty stuff like how to use SAS to help with it, how to use Grunt to help with it, how do you automate it, how do you deal with responsive in HTML emails, so how does content strategy work with all that type of stuff. All these types of things are covered in the talks. And this is happening April 1st through 3rd. So April 1st, April 2nd, April 3rd, it's a 3-day thing. You can buy a ticket for just one day, 2 days, 3 days, however you want to do it. Speakers like Dan Moll, been on the show. Brad Frost, been on the show. Trent Walton, been on the show. Dave's partner in crime. Jen Lucas, been on the show. People that you know from the show, they're going to be there and they're going to be speaking, and you can attend it from the chair that you're sitting in right now, probably, unless it's your car, and then don't do that.
Dangerous. You know, it's on, and you can like get, they also offer like whole room rates, you know, like if you're gonna have a whole room of your office, like just check in and attend, like just have it on in a conference room all day, they offer rates for that. So like, hello, business expense. Get everyone on your team like up to speed on responsive.
That would be just fun anyway. And save 20% when you do that with the coupon code ShopTalkShow. That's good for anything. Oh, thanks for your sponsorship, Environments for Humans. We got one here from Shay Bunge.
No, you got it. Go ahead.
I am looking to get started with Twitter Bootstrap. The trouble is Bootstrap uses less. I much prefer SAS. I can find plenty of SAS Bootstrap projects that are provided as a Ruby gem or Compass or Rails. However, I prefer to work with libsass and Grunt. Do you know of a port of Bootstrap that is more intended for Grunt and SAS workflow?
That's some sticky, that's some requirements.
Yeah.
Twitter Bootstrap now has an official SAS port. But let me...
they kind of do. I tweeted that the other day, and then somebody's like, oh, that's been around forever. I'm like, well, it's now in the SaaS, like...
Well, it's under the TWBS.
Right. It's under the Twitter Bootstrap account. Yeah. So maybe they just moved it over or whatever, but that's an endorsement, right? When you're like, this is under our roof now. We have this now. And it does use the Ruby version. So if anybody doesn't know what Shay was talking about there, LibSass is like a C port of it, and it's super duper duper fast, right? I love it. I would use it mostly when I can, but it's like behind. The classic thing is it doesn't have extend, and there's a few things that don't work in LibSass quite as well. I don't know if Bootstrap will compile in LibSass. It sounds like probably not.
I see a LibSass compatible quotes commit message. So maybe there's some work to get it LibSass compatible. So
possibly. I think LibSass has some legs recently too. I don't know if it will ever be the canonical project for, you know, SaaS. I kind of doubt it. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing, Shay, like Grunt doesn't, like I don't know if that I've ever really, I know that there's a LibSass and Grunt means that like your whole stack is Node or whatever, then you don't have to have this Ruby dependency and that's cool or whatever. But like Grunt can happily compile your Ruby version of SaaS too. So like, sure. I don't know if I would like let the, like my little like stack desires dictate what's going to happen and how I write code like, in my project.
Don't get religious about your compiler, maybe.
Yeah, that's kind of how I'm feeling about that. Maybe you have some really good reasons for it because you have like a whole bunch of people all over the office and you're all going to use it and they're all using different things. And like if we added Ruby to the stack, it would really be a real big pain in the ass. But I never see that. It's always somebody just being a little righteous about it. Just use the stupid Ruby.
Yeah, I could see like Windows is a bit of a deal. Yeah. Maybe your deployment environment, your deploy flow is just a Node box. It's not like doesn't have a Ruby on it. But I don't know. I would, yeah. If you want to use Bootstrap, like get to it. Or
just use less, you know, whatever.
Or don't use Twitter Bootstrap.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean if you're on the like Grunt Node flow, just use the less version. I mean that's, you know, like that's gonna be your win there.
Plus it'll be really fast.
That'd be really fast. Anyway, you got it?
Yeah, that's that's fine.
Quentin Jason writes in, love the show, keeps me informed. I hope so. Good luck. I've been trying to figure out the right way to handle content hiding. I've seen preferred methods of accomplishing this and was ready to dig into it after reading over the Google Webmaster article about hiding text and links, which goes against some practices. I worry that it could come back to bite me. Any thoughts?
Kind of accessible hiding methods, right? This has been talked about. I don't know. I don't know how much we've ever talked about it, but it's the kind of thing that's like not display none, right? Display none, bad, mm-hmm. not accessible because screen readers will hide it and other various mm-hmm. reasons. Even Google might kind of
ding you just because they think you're trying to be spammy because you're hiding a bunch of content. But so for me, like, so the web standards, puritanical, like, this is me. I think the web is pure. Like, I think, like, you should never hide content for people. Like every device should get the same content, right? That's kind of the accessibility thing is, like, every user should have access to the same content. But there are times where you do have to hide. Like, if you're doing an icon font or something like that, that accessible text, which you want to have, you have to kind of hide using some stuff, or you have to hide the icon using Aria Hidden. So it starts getting, you know, kind of strange. That I use a visibility hidden method from, geez, is it
really?
Thierry Koblenz? And it's like, that's for like just, it basically makes it uses the rect function.
Oh, and, that's how you make sure it's 0, 0 with height.
Yeah, so it basically squeezes the thing down to nothing, but it's still readable.
Hmm. And that's, because it doesn't have to. Cause a lot of people use -9999 pics and just kick it way off the page with position absolute,
and that's okay too.
Yeah,
but you kind of risk Hey, what if there are monitors one day? That'll be a terrible day. But then like you draw this huge box and it can have like scrolling performance and stuff. Like a drawing box for the web page is really big. If you go into, if you go into Mozilla's 3D inspector, you can see that stuff and it's pretty wild to look at.
I had a funny one happening where I used that. And then what I was hiding was I just made this change on CodePen. I think it's a good plan, but I made it so that like instead of like let's say you write a pen on CodePen, you have there's all the CSS, HTML and JavaScript, right? When you go to the /pen page, it used to just like all the data of all the code that you wrote, we just like had, you know, in like some JSON, and then we create the editors from that JSON code that we had, you know? So like on the page itself, if you view source, none of that stuff is there. So like to Google, every pen just looked exactly the same pretty much. I mean, we changed the title and description and stuff, but for the most part, pens looked the same. And like accessibility is a weird topic on CodePen, right? Because the whole app is so specific, where it's shooting stuff over to iframes and stuff. It's probably not very accessible. Sorry about that. Maybe we can do better there, but it's a weird thing. It's not, I feel strongly about accessibility, but perhaps more so on a site like CSS Strix where it's reading and it's important content that should be able to be read. But I don't even know how to approach it on CodePen. It's so abstract. Anyway, what I did do is at least I made the document more correct. You know, instead of hiding that data away in some JSON, which we injected in a special way, it's just on the page. It's in there in a pre and code tag now. So at least all these pens are like, it is the content that someone created, right? Probably a good move, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, you're giving access to the content. In some manner.
Yeah, you know? Just a small change, but better. And hopefully it's good for SEO and maybe a little bit of accessibility if somebody finds that. I don't know. Their document is more correct this way. Anyway, I needed to hide those pre and code tags because their style, they look totally bogus and wrong and weird and unsyntax highlighted and stuff. I'm like, nobody needs to see this before the editor gets built in that split second. So I hit it. I threw it way off the page. But some people's code was like so long in one line so that you could like see, even though I made negative 999. It made it all the way into the page. And I was like, what is that? Yeah. So
like an SVG.
Yeah. So I had to, I just made it a smaller width and hid the overflow. So as I'm kicking it off the page and I'm doing that, but I should probably just do the clip one. Then it doesn't have to render off page at all.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you could also, yeah, I think you could totally do that. Yeah. It's, I like it just cause I know it's kind of like the accessible thumbs up version. And there's a few like the font zero, but then you have to reset your font size and stuff like that.
And it's only for text really.
And then like Quentin, I hope you're not like, well, you can do whatever you want. You're a smart guy, but, like Bootstrap has these like is mobile, is tablet, is desktop. And then it'll like, if it's not that, and it also has hide tablet, hide phone or whatever, hide desktop. It has those kinds of, like classes. Try to avoid that, man. Like, I don't know. That's where the purist in me is just like same content. Don't like just hide modules just because you couldn't fit it. But you know, like I know a lot of web shops that do that and it's just fine. But and they're just display nunning and then they'll show like Foundation does that. Like for if you have an off canvas nav, you have to write out two navigations, a mobile one and a desktop one or whatever. So it's just something to I like to try not to repeat myself if possible.
Oh, absolutely.
Anyhow, Mr. Chris,
Mr. John Deere, not.
Better finish it off right. I'm struggling.
Got it. You nailed it.
All right, next.
Mr. John Deere anonymously writes in, how do you handle a boss that gets upset when you ask him about devices that we'll be supporting for a project? Asking things like what browser version for that device or more specifics regarding the OS version number of, say, Android. That kind of stuff drives him crazy. this is mainly a print-based company, so I feel like they're just not there yet with their web stuff and don't get these specifics with the client or developers internally. So John Deere is just kind of like, he wants to be like, hey, are we supporting Android 2.3? Are we Android 4?
Maybe John Deere should be more worried about what tractors they support. This is tough. We at Parvo, we bake all this into our proposal process. We just have a little line that's like supported devices, and it's more or less just the browser stack list of devices, you know, cause that's like stuff we have access to testing, you know, in some capability. And we even like brought the Android up just because we're like, you know, like it's going to cost more money for us to like completely support Android 2 like on an A grade, you know. So I think your answer there is maybe just you building out a browser support chart and like with ABC grades, and you know, and that's kind of where you're at. I mean, I like the two versions back approach, but it doesn't always work in reality.
Yeah. I think I'm focusing more on the fact that you're boss is getting mad about it. Like, that's a little weird. You could think that, I don't know, like in what context is it ever cool to get mad at your own employees over something so stupid like that? Maybe you could just be like, hey, I don't know very much about this. What do you think we should support? Or like, listen, I'm not the guy to ask about this kind of thing. Maybe you guys could come up with your own strategy for it or something like you think there's all kinds of different ways that you could handle this without being mad.
Why is the boss not delegating it? That's weird. Yeah. You'd think he'd just be like, yeah, sure.
I'm not going to be like, you should quit and get another job, but maybe you could handle it in a way. Maybe you could have a proposal and you could say, hey, look, this is what I think is realistic for us as developers who are kind of down here in the nitty gritty.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just like make a chart and just like float it by him or whoever writes your proposals and just be like, hey, this sort of helps us like scope out how much it costs, you know, like if you're getting into a question about cost, your boss will suddenly care. So that's smart to do, you know?
Well,
all right.
Can we do one more? Would that be acceptable for this show? We've gotten to a lot of them.
Yeah. We got to a lot. Let's do one more. Let's see. This one's going to take a long time to read, but I think we can answer it. Are you ready?
Yep.
Thomas Wicker writes in, I'm a front-end dev from Denver, longtime listener. I look forward to the show every week. Quick question. Where in the bleep can I, when can I bleeping stop support IE8 and for that matter, IE9? They're essentially the only browsers left preventing me from the newer features of CSS3, HTML5, etc. IE has been a pain in my side for years, and I really feel like we're almost at that point to put it out to the pasture. I understand client work, you have to bend to their needs and requirements, but for my work, my personal website, my company website, personal projects, and things I build for friends, what's the support threshold? On my personal site, I choose to redirect to a page that refuses IE8 support. But I still tend to get clients and employers, potential employers on the phone, browsing the portfolio in IE.005, and they freak out that I'm not savvy or understand back browser support. I think we are finally to the point where IE8 can hopefully soon and IE9 again be put to pasture. So,
wow.
Do you know of any percentages, general browsing stats for a particular version? Thanks.
I don't know. This is interesting from both of our perspectives. I actually just wrote a comment about this today because I wrote a little something about Flexbox and I posted it on my site. And there was somebody that just, you know, of course, the inevitable discussion is, yeah, but we can't use it ever. And I was like, okay, well, you're coming at this from a perspective of the types of projects that you work on have some kind of level of browser support that doesn't support it, and that you can't imagine a day when they do. Like, it seems so far out to you to support it, and maybe that's rightfully so with Flexbox. Maybe because it's an IE10 minimum with Flexbox, that seems like crazy far out, and maybe Dave even feels that way because you've done some work with Microsoft, which I believe they said IE8 minimum, right? So, I mean,
No, actually, Microsoft went back to IE6 because they had IE6 traffic.
Right. Okay. So that's
unique to their situation.
But you have worked on other projects since then where there was at least an IE8 minimum, right? Or
yeah. Yep. Yep. I'm actually on my first project with an IE9 minimum.
Sure. And even then, Flexbox is out. So to anybody, this probably does feel like pretty futuristic, not happening anytime soon stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so IE7 is almost dead. Like the upgrade path there is pretty good. It's at 0.3%. IE6 is more or less dead. I really
when you say numbers like that, are you doing some stack counter stuff, or are they for this project?
Yeah, I'm at gs.stackcounter.com.
Sure,
and that's like global stack.
These things enable these conversations. So useful, right? It's nice to know where the world is at on these kind of things. But what I was commenting about to this guy, I said, "Well, here's the stats that actually matter." And there's a post of this name on CSS Tricks that's like, that stuff is nice for conversational levels. But if you're talking about a particular project, there's only one stat you should ever quote in a conversation, and it's the stats that come from that site. Mm-hmm. So that's what you need to look at. And then even still, that's just data to inform other decisions. Like, how much do you care about those numbers, and which way are those numbers kind of going down? And what I said was that, like, well, here's the thing. If I was going to make a website that, you know, sold eyeglasses or something, I would maybe even go back to IE6. I mean, I would look at the data and stuff, but that kind of thing, there's money involved there. There's accessibility concerns there. There's just kind of doing the right thing involved there. I would go really far back. I would, but it just so happens that I work on some pretty kind of futuristic projects, and including something like CSS Tricks. You know, I know that what the traffic is like. I have lots and lots of data on it, and I don't really care. The next one, I might use Flexbox all over it and be like, "Oh, your site looks weird in IE9. Oh, sorry, I don't care. Yeah. I just don't, because it's my own personal site and whatever. There's not a lot of money on the line. The type of people that I'm trying to talk to are developers, and you're the type of person who knows how to change browsers if you need to. So there's that factors in too, just that kind of emotional level behind it. But I'm not trying to say that that's right for every single project. So Thomas, the point of your writing in was, when can we stop supporting IE8? Well, you can when the project that you're working on, the data from it suggests that it's at a low enough level that you're comfortable with, or that you don't care.
Yeah. I mean, he's kind of like, his personal site, he redirects to a I hate IE8 page. I think that's maybe the worst thing you can do. I think, like, I would just have like a, in lieu of that, have like a conditional banner or something that drops down and is just like, or shows at the top of the site.
Apologetic, like, or can you serve a classic IE8 or a stripped down style sheet? That was a classic popular thing to do for a long time. I still do that on CSS.
I think, like, you know, it's sort of like, what did you do? You know, I don't have access to your personal site right now, but, you know, like, what's so hard about IE8 is that's what comes into my mind. I mean, JavaScript is obviously the big one. You know, there's a big difference in the JavaScript.
And no API, CSS3, but that's usually not important for layout-y stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the most important thing we can know as, like, web developers is how this stuff breaks down and how it degrades, so that you can kind of code in fallbacks against it. I mean, you can test your site in IE8 using a browser stack or a VM or something like that. It's pretty easy to do. That said, you know, I haven't ran my site through it, but you know, if you get people freaking out, then you should probably check it out.
Well, he literally says in here that his potential's employers have been on the phone with him looking at his portfolio, and they freak out that you're not savvy enough to provide back browser support. That's the worst case scenario. That's a bummer. Mm-hmm. And that's enough data for you to say that you probably should do something.
Yeah, at least a tube of content, you know? Yeah. I mean, like, you know, maybe every style. You know, again, it's like this is where kind of the mobile first thinking and progressive enhancement kind of come into play. It's like if your browser's not good, you just get the mobile site, basically, you know, and people might freak out, you know, but maybe you're like, oh, you know, IE8 supports floats. So maybe I'll float this, like, gallery of images, but that's it. I'm not going to worry about it beyond that. So, And then that's it too, is just how much do you want to care? You know, it's a money thing. It's like, do you want to spend $2,000 worth of your own personal effort, you know, on an hourly basis or whatever that is, you know, to make $3,000 from a client or something like that? You know, you need to kind of weigh that out. So think about that.
Very true. I don't want to be too dogmatic about any of that stuff. It's just to weigh it all out.
All right. Well, hey, thank you, everybody, for listening to another Rapid Fire episode. It's been
excellent.
And I hope you're not all like,
dang,
I'm frustrated because
I like donut charts. I think they're super rad.
Yep. That's all I got. Hey, be sure to follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. Give us a .NET award if that thing's still happening. I'm not sure. And if you also tell your mom to listen to the show.
Definitely have your mom. Maybe watch it together.
We should do a Jimmy Kimmel kind of thing. Like, hey, mom, I want you to listen to Shop Talk. And you write a you record a video. She's just like, what is this crap? Yeah, that'd be good. All right. Hey. We appreciate it, guys. Chris, you got anything you want to say?
Go to shoptalkshow.com.